Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Tuesday, October 13th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Here are some of the things that we'll be bringing you this hour. A new University of Texas, Texas Tribune poll that shows fears about the coronavirus have dipped from the April peak, but remain high in Texas. Also, Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine study is paused for unexplained illness. Rising COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations may be the start of another virus surge in the U.S., officials warn. Texas governor sends help to El Paso as virus spikes in border city. Trying to reach herd immunity is unethical, WHO director says. Senate majority leader will bring up bill to restart small business loan program next week. Landlords and lobbyists launch legal war against Trump's eviction moratorium. And a second wave of mental health devastation due to COVID-19 is imminent, experts say. First, we'll take a look at the numbers this afternoon. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 5,347. Ector County negative, 23,912 out of 29,593 tested, with 334 pending, 102 deaths. Recovered, 4,488. Active, 757. Midland County, 4,176 confirmed cases with 85 deaths. And from the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased by 136 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On October 12th, 2,384 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 552 patients compared with a week ago. As of October 12th, 3,870 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths stayed the same compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On October 12th, one new death was reported. Now we'll take a look at coronavirus briefs. As President Trump returned to the campaign trail, Anthony S. Fauci told CNN that he was asking for trouble by holding crowded rallies where many people do not wear masks. Sean Conley, Trump's doctor, said Monday that the president had tested negative for the coronavirus on consecutive days, although he did not state which days. A new report in the journal Lancet Infectious Diseases confirmed that a 25-year-old man from Reno, Nevada, had the first known U.S. case of coronavirus reinfection. An 89-year-old woman in the Netherlands died after being infected with the coronavirus for a second time. Dutch News reported Monday. Her case marks the first confirmed death from a reinfection. The United States reported 41,653 new COVID-19 infections and 317 virus-related fatalities on Monday, according to Johns Hopkins University. That raises the country's total to at least 7,804,197 cases and 215,085 deaths. Delta Airlines warns investors it may be 2 years or more for air travel to recover from the pandemic. Now here are some articles. First, from the Texas Tribune. Fears about coronavirus dip from April peak but remain high, UTTT poll says. Texas voters are still concerned about the spread of the coronavirus in their communities, but not as worried as they were in April, according to the latest University of Texas, Texas Tribune poll. In the latest survey, 40% said they are extremely or very concerned about the spread of infections. 30% said they were not very or not at all concerned. In April, 54% were extremely or very concerned, while 17% were unconcerned. The vast majority of Texas voters believe the coronavirus is serious, but Democrats are much more likely than Republicans to consider it a significant crisis. Among all voters, 53% consider the pandemic a significant crisis, but that majority is driven by the 87% of Democrats who classify it that way. Among Republicans, only 24% consider it a crisis, while 47% chose it's a serious problem but not a crisis to characterize their view. More than one in four Republicans, 27%, said COVID-19 is either a minor problem or not a problem. Only 3% of Democrats share that view. Groups that have been more likely to suffer from COVID-19 were more likely to see it as a crisis. Among black voters, 75% classify it that way. Among Hispanic voters, 65% do. Among white voters, 44% call the coronavirus a significant crisis. Rating responses to the pandemic. Voters have soured a bit on institutional responses to the pandemic. Overall, approval of the federal government response dropped 10 points from 49% in April at the beginning of the official response to 39% in the current survey. Assessments of the state response dropped 12 points, and voter views of local government responses dropped 13 points from April to October. Even so, 51% of voters approve of the response from local government, compared with 45% approval of state government responses and 39% approval of the federal government response. Republican voters were more approving of government responses to the coronavirus. 71% approve of the state response, 65% approve the federal response, and 59% approve of local responses. Among Democrats, 46% approve of local, 19% of state, and 15% of federal responses to the pandemic. Those sentiments are echoed in voters' assessment of efforts to deal with the coronavirus in the U.S. and Texas. Overall, 45% say things are going very or somewhat well in the U.S., down from 56% who thought so in April. Republicans are much more sanguine. 71% say things are going well. Only 19% of Democrats share that opinion. The state numbers are similar. Overall, 51% say state efforts are going well, including 77% of Republicans and 24% of Democrats. In April, 66% of Texas voters thought the state efforts were going well. Texas voters seem to have settled into their expectations about how long the pandemic's effects will last. Asked how long it will take for things like social gatherings, workplaces, and sporting events to return to normal, 55% said that will happen either in the next year or a year or more. About as many, 42%, were more optimistic, choosing it is already, in the next few weeks or in the next few months. That's a distinct change from April, when 71% were expecting a quick end to the pandemic and only 26% who expected the return to normal to come in the next year or longer. COVID-19, the economy, and public education. Half of Texas voters said it's more important to help control the spread of the coronavirus, even if it hurts the economy, while 39% would prefer to help the economy, even if that hurts efforts to control the spread of the coronavirus. The results were similar for a question that posed children being taught in person at their public schools, even if it hurts efforts to control the spread of the coronavirus, against controlling the disease, even if public education has to take place over the internet with children at home. While 34% said they'd prefer having their kids in school, 55% set controlling COVID-19 as their priority. Views on vaccines. If a vaccine against the coronavirus became available at a low cost, 42% of Texas registered voters said they would try to get it, and 36% said they wouldn't, according to the latest UTTT poll. That's a significant drop from the 59% who said in a UT Texas Politics Project poll in June that they would get vaccinated against the disease. Voters are also skeptical about the quality of such a vaccine. 41% said they think a coronavirus vaccine will be made available before it is proven safe and effective. Republicans were more likely to believe a vaccine will be proven safe before it's released, but less likely to get vaccinated. While only 30% said an unproven medicine will be made available, only 38% said they would try to get it once it came out. A majority of Democrats, 51%, said they think a vaccine would be introduced before it's proven, but 51% said they would get a vaccine that's widely available at a low cost. Getting out of the house. Most Texans are being careful about leaving home during the pandemic, but the number, only leaving my residence when I absolutely have to, is half of what it was last April. Then, 63% of registered voters were staying home except for urgent errands. Now that's 32%, a cohort of stay-at-home Texans. That includes 46% of Hispanic voters, 33% of Black voters, and 27% of white voters. Almost as many, 27%, said that they are living normally, coming and going as usual. In April, only 9% were out and about. The biggest group now, 40% of the voters, said they are still leaving my residence, but being careful when I do. Among white voters, 73% said either that they were coming and going normally or being careful when they leave their homes. Among Black voters, 66% said they're behaving that way, although they were less likely to say they were acting as they did before the pandemic. Hispanic voters are more wary. 50% said they're getting out of their homes when it's not absolutely necessary. About 1 in 4 voters said they've had conflicts with family or close friends about the precautions they're taking in response to the pandemic. Younger people were more likely to report that kind of friction. Among 18 to 29-year-olds, 38% said they've had conflicts, and 35% of 30 to 44-year-olds said the same. Only 20% of 45 to 64-year-olds reported conflicts with family and friends, and only 17% of voters over 65 years of age did. Taking precautions. Texans say they're doing the things the health professionals have advised. Wearing masks, 87%. Washing their hands, 87%. Avoiding other people as much as possible, 74%. And large groups in particular, 83%. Just over two-thirds, 68%, said they are avoiding touching their faces. Masks, which have become politically charged symbols of responses to the pandemic, illustrate that. Virtually all Democrats, 98%, said they're wearing masks when in close contact with people outside their own households. Among Republicans, 78% said the same, a lower percentage, but still a huge majority. Men, 83%, were less likely than women, 90%, to say they're wearing masks, but the vast majority are. Among white voters, 83% said they're wearing masks, 89% of Black voters, and 96% of Hispanic voters said the same. The University of Texas, Texas Tribune Internet Survey of 1,200 registered voters was conducted from September 25th through October 4th and has an overall margin of error of plus or minus 2.83 percentage points. Numbers and charts might not add up to 100% because of rounding. Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine study is paused for unexplained illness. Pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson has paused its 60,000-person coronavirus vaccine trial after a participant fell ill with an unexplained illness. The company began its trial of a single-shot vaccine, the fourth-largest U.S. coronavirus vaccine trial, on September 23rd. Johnson & Johnson disclosed an unexplained illness in a study participant in a press release after it was reported by Stat News. Company spokesman Jake Sargent declined to offer further details of the illness. The event triggered predetermined rules that ensure our studies may be paused if an unexpected serious adverse event that might be related to a vaccine or study drug is reported, so there can be a careful review of all of the medical information before deciding whether to restart the study, the statement said. A clinical trial of a vaccine from AstraZeneca has been paused since a possible adverse event occurred with a patient in a British trial. That trial has resumed in other countries, but has been put on hold by U.S. regulators at the Food and Drug Administration, who continue to study the event to determine if the illness could have been related to the vaccine. FDA continues to review safety information, and we'll just have to see over the next week or so where that turns out, said Paul Mango, Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy at the Department of Health and Human Services, at a briefing on Friday. Rising COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations may be the start of another virus surge in U.S., officials warn. With 33 states reporting a rise in new COVID-19 cases and a nationwide uptick in hospitalizations, officials worry this could be the beginning of a fall surge experts have warned about. In Colorado, Denver Mayor Michael Hancock said COVID-19 cases were rising at a concerning rate and warned new restrictions could be needed, with the city's 7-day average daily case rates as high right now as they were at the height of the pandemic back in May. Officials across the country are warning of similar patterns. White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx last week cautioned that the Northeast was seeing early suggestions of alarming trends. Kentucky's governor said recently the state is seeing a third major escalation in infections. And in Wisconsin, a field hospital is opening this week in response to a surge in COVID-19 patients, days after the state reported record high numbers of COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and daily deaths. The U.S. is now averaging more than 49,000 new infections daily, up 14% from the previous week, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Last week, the nation recorded more than 50,000 new cases for at least 4 days in a row. The last time that happened was in early August. "I think we're facing a whole lot of trouble," Dr. Anthony Fauci told CNBC on Monday. "We've got to turn this around." That doesn't have to mean another lockdown, the infectious disease expert has previously said, but means more people heeding to safety guidelines like wearing masks and social distancing. Otherwise, the U.S. could be in for a devastating winter. Researchers from the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation project that more than 135,000 Americans could die within the next 3 months. Texas governor sends help to El Paso as virus spikes in border city. From Marfa Public Radio. Texas Governor Greg Abbott is sending more than 70 health workers to the border city of El Paso as a resurgence of the coronavirus has officials warning of virus fatigue and urging residents to take precautions. Abbott said Monday the surge of state resources includes nurses and respiratory therapists, among other medical personnel, along with a stockpile of personal protective equipment. He said 169 health workers were previously deployed to the city. El Paso on Friday reported 546 new virus cases, its highest daily count since the pandemic began, and a drastic reversal from just a month ago when new case counts had significantly dropped after a previous summer spike. The outbreak in El Paso comes as the West Texas city of Lubbock also deals with the resurgence of the virus. That city hit a new record for COVID-19 hospitalizations over the weekend, the Lubbock Avalanche Journal reported. Trying to reach herd immunity is unethical, WHO head says. The head of the World Health Organization said Monday that allowing the coronavirus to spread in an attempt to reach herd immunity was simply unethical. Saying that there had been some discussion about the concept recently, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus told reporters that allowing people to be exposed to a deadly virus whose effects are still not fully known was not an option. "Never in the history of public health has herd immunity been used as a strategy for responding to an outbreak, let alone a pandemic," he said at a Monday briefing. "It is scientifically and ethically problematic." Typically, herd immunity describes a scenario where a large enough share of the population has been vaccinated against a disease to prevent it from spreading widely, allowing the minority of people who have not been vaccinated to be protected by default. But since no vaccine is available for the coronavirus, achieving herd immunity would theoretically require a large number of people to contract the virus. "But among the many unknown factors is whether herd immunity is even possible," Tedros said. "Most people who are infected with the virus that causes COVID-19 develop an immune response within the first few weeks, but we don't know how strong or lasting that immune response is, or how it differs from different people," he said, noting that there are multiple documented instances of people being infected for a second time after recovering from COVID-19. Antibody studies suggest that less than 10% of people in most countries have contracted the coronavirus, Tedros said. Nowhere near the majority that would be needed for herd immunity. With the vast majority of the world's population susceptible, letting the virus spread means allowing unnecessary infections, suffering, and death, he said. Senate Majority Leader will bring up bill to restart small business loan program next week. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, in a statement Tuesday, announced Senate Republicans will attempt to move forward on a targeted bill to restart the small business loan program that served as a centerpiece of the coronavirus relief efforts when the Senate returns to session next week. Republicans do not agree that nothing is better than something for working families, McConnell said in the statement. The American people need Democrats to stop blocking bipartisan funding and let us replenish the PPP before more Americans lose their jobs needlessly. The effort is likely to be blocked. Democratic leaders have repeatedly rejected piecemeal approaches to the next relief effort, including a roughly $300 billion Senate GOP relief bill, which Democrats voted unanimously against last month. Instead, they have insisted on a broad, comprehensive response to the twin economic and public health issues facing the country. Those negotiations, however, have remained at a stalemate for months. While President Donald Trump offered a momentary boost to the prospects of an agreement last week when he called for a big deal and proposed a $1.8 trillion offer, Speaker Nancy Pelosi has rejected the effort, and the talks are once again stuck without a clear path forward. Pelosi, in a letter to her House Democratic colleagues Tuesday, listed off a myriad of significant issues with the latest Trump administration proposal. Significant changes must be made to remedy the Trump proposal's deficiencies, Pelosi wrote to her colleagues. The Senate GOP move, which aides have said was under discussion for several days, follows a request to lawmakers from Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to pass a bill restarting the small business loan program, known as the Paycheck Protection Program. The program came to an end with roughly $130 billion in funds unspent. Pelosi to House Democrats on stimulus. Significant changes must be made to remedy Trump's proposal's deficiencies. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, in a letter to House Democrats Tuesday morning, detailed a series of major differences between Democrats and the Trump administration in their stimulus negotiation, underscoring that the two sides are nowhere near an agreement. Pelosi laid out eight key areas where tangible differences exist between the two sides. The issues largely mirror the splits that have existed between them for more than 3 months. Pelosi also made clear that those eight areas are not exhaustive of our many outstanding concerns. Significant changes must be made to remedy the Trump's proposal's deficiencies, Pelosi wrote to her colleagues. Landlords and lobbyists launch legal war against Trump's eviction moratorium. Landlords, apartment owners, and housing industry groups have unleashed a barrage of legal challenges against the Trump administration's order protecting renters from eviction, leaving millions of families once again facing the risk of homelessness in the middle of a deadly pandemic. Over the past month, an array of lawyers and lobbyists have inundated federal, state, and local courts. They have sought to stop renters from invoking the federal ban, and in some cases, they've tried to quash the policy altogether, arguing that the government did not have the authority to issue it in the first place. The legal plight facing millions of cash-strapped renters highlights the nature of the nation's unequal recovery, as Americans who struggled most at the outset of the pandemic continue to face severe hardship, even as the economy begins to improve. About one in three adults say it is somewhat or very likely they could face the threat of eviction or foreclosure over the next 2 months, according to survey data released last week by the U.S. Census Bureau, underscoring how sustained unemployment and dwindling federal aid may be creating the conditions for a housing crisis. In September, the Trump administration sought to address the issue through an order that tapped the nation's public health laws to prevent people who are behind on their rent from being pushed out of their homes. Federal officials predicted the protections could help as many as 40 million Americans, far more than the original 120-day eviction moratorium approved by Congress in March. But the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which issued the updated policy, limited its order in critical ways. It included no new money to help people catch up on their bills, and it didn't authorize any new aid to make landlords financially whole either. Instead, it directed renters to existing sources of state and federal help, and it guaranteed that property managers could assess fees and other penalties on families who fall behind on their payments. The absence of an immediate fresh injection of federal dollars has exacerbated the cash crunch for tenants who are amassing bills they cannot repay, as well as for landlords who cannot evict or collect past due amounts. The National Council of State Housing Agencies in late September estimated that the financial hole is vast and growing fast, with potentially 14 million renter households, totaling approximately 34 million Americans, projected to owe as much as $34 billion by the time the CDC moratorium expires at the end of 2020. And that brings us to our first pre-recorded reports today. Both of these are from the Texas Standard. First, it's in Houston, whether or not you're evicted can depend on the judge. And following that is how Houston area families are being forced from their homes without an eviction notice.
The pandemic has put evictions on hold in the three biggest cities in the country, New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. But for number four, Houston, it's a different story. Harris County courts have heard more than 2,800 eviction cases just since a CDC national moratorium took effect last month. Houston Public Media's Jen Rice tells us why that moratorium isn't protecting everyone.
Shamika Smith is used to helping others. She's a nursing student in Clear Lake and had planned to assist elderly folks and veterans with social services this year.
I'm that person that was going to go to their home and help them. I was the caseworker that they was going to see with a smile on their face.
That job evaporated with the pandemic. Now she's in the uncomfortable position of needing help herself. She got temporary rent relief, but she's emptied her savings while applying for jobs. Running out of luck, she went online and found out about the CDC eviction moratorium. She read the rules, printed out the form, and gave it to the apartment manager. She saw them throw it in the trash, and she was told,
We're not participating in this program. And at that point in time, I just let them know, hey, this is not a program, the CDC, this is what's going on. A couple hours later, she put eviction notice on my door.
A lot of renters would probably leave at this point. Because the moratorium doesn't automatically stop evictions, it was up to Smith to know her rights. So she gave them the form again in an email. This time, they agreed not to file a case.
I'm just trying to stay positive about the situation and stay focused. That's all I can do. My goal is to pay them. That's my entire goal, is to pay my rent and go forward.
It's just one example of the moratorium's chaotic and uneven results in the Houston area. Less than 3% of renters in Harris County eviction courts have legal representation, so most are on their own. The outcome can depend on the judge. Take Justice of the Peace Holly Williamson. One day this week, I watched Judge Williamson livestream her court from Pasadena. She stopped almost every eviction case on her docket. Even if the renter didn't know their rights, Williamson took the time to find out if they qualified for the CDC moratorium. That's nearly the opposite approach of Justice of the Peace Lincoln Goodwin, also a Republican. His courtroom in the Spring area was packed. I'm leaving JP Court now. They heard 63 eviction cases at once on the docket today. Most renters didn't show up, so they got evicted. Goodwin told everyone else that the outcome likely wouldn't be in their favor if they owed rent. I saw most cases end in eviction and didn't see the CDC moratorium stop them. So many Houston area renters are still being evicted that City Councilmember Letitia Plummer has been going door to door at apartment complexes to give people the legal declaration form they need.
Right now we're in like the Sunnyside, Selinsky area, and we're just letting people know that that's a declaration, that they do have rights, they don't have to move right now.
When renters don't get the message in time, some are still desperately trying to avoid eviction even after their court date. That's what Jonna Treble saw last week. She's an attorney with Lone Star Legal Aid and works with their Eviction Right to Counsel program. Treble got an emergency call. A woman said she was being evicted, and the constable's deputy was headed over to remove her.
He was literally on the way. She was standing in her front yard, melting down because she had dragged all of her belongings out into the yard and were trying to load it into a truck that she had nowhere to take the truck to, but she just wanted to try and keep as much of her stuff as she could.
The caller met the CDC qualifications, so Treble raced to get the CDC form to the constable, the court, and the landlord. She says her hands were shaking.
When I called her back, I think there was a lot of relief and some happy tears.
The CDC moratorium doesn't cancel any rent. Treble says this renter will still have to pay when the order ends, but it means she'll have 3 months to catch her breath. I'm Jen Rice in Houston.
Across Texas, many of the state's most vulnerable are struggling to cover costs during the pandemic, chief among those costs, the rent. Rent relief programs and the CDC eviction moratorium are meant to protect them, but many are still forced out without an official eviction order. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval brings us the story of one Houston family.
I met Cristina Rea, her boyfriend, and his mom at their trailer park in North Houston. All three wear masks and show me around. They've been almost 3 months without electricity during some of Houston's hottest months.
Al tercer día que vino, solo vino y cortó todo.
Rea explains how their landlord cut off power when they were a few days late with rent. It's not right, she says. The family had been tenants there for more than a decade.
Tenía que ser un poco tolerante después de tantos años que han vivido aquí.
Now they're sleeping in their silver car on and off. Even if they could pay rent, they can't stay in the trailer anymore. Juan Miranda tries to show me inside.
I barely can open the door.
The roof has partially collapsed. Debris is everywhere.
Oh my gosh.
Everything's knocked out. So I lost everything from inside.
When was that?
When the storm hit, the Hurricane Beta.
The smell of rot escapes through the wedged open door. Inside, the family's clothes, shoes, and microwave are all likely destroyed. It's the latest in a string of poor luck since the pandemic. The couples struggled to find work, which is why they were late on rent. Rea hasn't received any government aid due to her immigration status, and Miranda didn't qualify for unemployment because he works informal construction jobs. They don't know who to turn to for help. Josephine Lee works with Latino immigrant families through the nonprofit El Pueblo Primero. She says many families are going through this. It's called self-eviction.
All this time, the landlord has been pressuring them through different tactics, right? Giving them notices to vacate, putting like a padlock on their door. And so in response, some people, you know, have been self-evicting because they don't want to go to court.
So those are the people that are getting evicted that are invisible.
That's Reverend Ed Gomez from San Pablo's Episcopal Church. He says he's seen people lose out on rent relief because their apartment is under another name.
They don't have leases in their names and so forth. They don't have utilities in their names. It's all under the person who they get to sign for them. And like that, there's probably thousands. It's the invisible Houston, you know?
Guadalupe Fernandez is with the Tahereh Justice Center and serves on the county's eviction task force. She gets frustrated about access to aid for families like the Mirandas.
My intention from the beginning has been, if you are not addressing and targeting the most vulnerable, right? Like, who are you actually helping?
Nonprofits, churches, and informal community groups have picked up the slack, and many funds have been depleted. Catholic Charities of Houston, for example, has provided over $1.6 million for mostly rent and utilities since March. They don't expect the need to let up anytime soon. For now, the Miranda family is trying to get back on their feet with only the clothes on their backs.
Me he tenido que levantar y estar pensando ahora qué voy a hacer mañana si no voy a trabajar.
Rea says it's hard to sleep thinking about where she's going to get money to eat. She has two young daughters who are staying with their aunt for now. She hopes she can reunite with them soon. I'm Elizabeth Troval in Houston.
Now turning to mental health. A second wave of mental health devastation due to COVID-19 is imminent, experts say. While the world struggles to manage the initial waves of death and disruption caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, there is mounting evidence accumulating that a second wave linking to rising cases of mental health and substance abuse disorders could be building, according to an article published Monday in the medical journal JAMA. A second wave of devastation is imminent, attributable to mental health consequences of COVID-19, wrote authors Dr. Naomi Simon, Dr. Glenn Sachs, and Dr. Charles Marmer, all from New York's University's Grossman School of Medicine. The magnitude of this second wave is likely to overwhelm the already frayed mental health system, leading to access problems, particularly for the most vulnerable persons. This second mental health wave, the researchers suggested, will bring further challenges, such as increased deaths from suicide and drug overdoses, and will have a disproportionate effect on the same groups that the first wave did: Black and Hispanic people, older adults, lower socioeconomic groups, and healthcare workers. This magnitude of death over a short period of time is an international tragedy on a historic scale, the author said. This interpersonal loss is compounded by societal disruption. Of central concern, the authors wrote, is the transformation of normal grief and distress into prolonged grief and major depressive disorder and symptoms of post-traumatic health disorder. We have a story that is also related to mental health, which takes it from a different angle. From NPR, anxiety and depression increased during the pandemic. Why not loneliness?
One thing we're all supposed to do these days to try and limit the spread of coronavirus is keep away from other people. But with physical separation, you get lonely, right? Reporter Joanne Silberner has found that actually the COVID-19 pandemic has not brought on a loneliness pandemic too.
On a typically chilly Saturday night in San Francisco earlier this summer, 63-year-old Dana Amorisa and her 93-year-old mother, Jean Lacey, are getting ready to go dancing in the street outside their house.
Ready to dance, Mom?
Early in the pandemic, Dana moved to San Francisco from Mexico, where she'd spent most evenings dancing on the beach.
All right.
The transition to her mom's home was difficult.
Were you experiencing any loneliness before this started?
Oh, Lord, yes. Oh, my gosh. I was transplanted from my home, my friends, my job.
So several months ago, she and her mom started a new COVID-19 tradition, physically distanced dance parties outside their home. They put up signs inviting neighbors to join in.
How are you? You came to dance? Yeah, well, you came to the right place.
Jean uses her walker. It's a fine dance partner, she says. In January, before the pandemic took hold, researchers at Florida State University College of Medicine asked 2,000 people around the country about loneliness. Are there people you can talk to? Are you part of a group of friends? Do you feel supported? They found a pretty high level of loneliness to start with, and they expected the pandemic would make things much worse. Angelina Sutton is one of the researchers.
There was a lot of fear early on because we are social animals and we want to be around other people. We want to be together.
But when they checked back with the survey participants in late March and late April, when many were under lockdown, they were surprised.
The thing that everybody thought was going to happen didn't happen.
While some people did report being lonelier, others reported being less lonely, and there was no overall increase in loneliness. They published their results in the journal American Psychologist and repeated the survey in July. Again, no jump in loneliness. Sutton says it looks to her like the efforts people made to stay connected, dance parties at a distance, Zoom chats, singing from balconies and porches, made a difference. A new survey from the University of Michigan did find feelings of isolation among people 50 to 80 years old, but other researchers looking into loneliness during the pandemic are not seeing an increase.
Our top line result is that we didn't see this massive wave of loneliness that was predicted.
That's University of Washington psychologist Jonathan Cantor. He and his team have been surveying people in Seattle and around the country. And a government survey in the United Kingdom and a national survey by the University of Southern California are also failing to find a loneliness pandemic. But there's something unusual going on here. Depression and anxiety are definitely increasing. Many studies have confirmed that. and those mood disorders have long been linked to loneliness. Sandro Galea is dean of the School of Public Health at Boston University. He found Sutton's surveys to be well done, but perplexing. He says there could be a lot that this pandemic can teach us about the link between loneliness, depression, and anxiety.
The relationship between social isolation, physical distancing, loneliness, how that mediates or does not mediate a relationship with depression or anxiety. I think that's a really interesting set of questions and one from which we can learn quite a bit.
The role of the digital world in mitigating loneliness may be worth exploring, he says. Meanwhile, back in San Francisco, Dana Amorisa and her mom plan to continue with their dance parties.
I love salsa.
Even after the pandemic ends.
Hi. Thanks for coming.
You're welcome.
For NPR News, I'm Joanne Solberner.
Staying with the mental health aspects, we have another short article. Physically, but not socially distant. How to reach out in the time of COVID. Social distance. It's a phrase that's become a mantra of the pandemic. We see the signs everywhere telling us to stay 6 feet apart, emphasizing the need for physical separation. While this is an important message to help keep us all safe, the phrase has it all wrong. We don't need to be socially distant. Physically apart, yes, but that social connection is exactly what we all need during this pandemic. It's an extremely challenging time with mental distress, Kevin Hines tells me. He's been an advocate for mental health for almost 20 years and knows how even a single moment of connection could change someone's life. On September 25th, 2000, when Hines was 19 years old, he walked to the middle of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, and as he stared down into the water, he waited for someone, anyone, to offer a kind word or even a friendly glance. That never happened. Hines jumped. Hines says even though we may not be able to physically reach out, put our hand on someone's shoulder, we can still offer those moments of support that could change the trajectory of someone's life. We have got to think of the people in our lives that don't have someone physically next to them to hold on to, he said. And we've got to be the people to make that phone call and make it on a regular basis. Here are ways Hines says we can all make sure we stay in this together. Call 3 to 5 people a day and use video. Ask for advice. Remember, it's not just about what you say. And never accept the first answer. Now here's an article from the Associated Press. Court reinstates Texas limit on ballot drop-off locations. A federal appeals court has reinstated a limit on the number of mail ballot drop-off locations in each county in Texas. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals late Monday issued a stay of a federal judge's ruling on Friday that Republican Governor Greg Abbott's order is a likely violation of a voter's right to vote. Early voting was starting Tuesday in Texas. Leaving the governor's October 1st proclamation in place still gives Texas absentee voters many ways to cast their ballots in the November 3rd election, Judge Stuart Kyle Duncan wrote in the opinion. These methods for remote voting outstrip what Texas law previously permitted in a pre-COVID world. The October 1st proclamation abridges no one's right to vote. Abbott's order limits each county to one location in each county where voters could drop off mail ballots during early voting for the November elections. The appeals court, however, noted that the order also provides Texas voters with 40 additional days to vote absentee, and they have many ways to cast ballots, including hand-delivering them or mailing them. Abbott said the limit on drop-off sites is needed to ensure election security, while Democrats and voting rights groups, including the League of United Latin American Citizens, called it an effort to suppress voters. The NFL could add a Week 18, but it prefers to wait till there's no other choice. Amid continued positive novel coronavirus tests involving numerous teams, the NFL has been forced to tinker with its regular season schedule in an unprecedented way. For instance, the New England Patriots Week 5 game against the Denver Broncos, which already had been pushed back once, now will be played the Sunday of Week 6, with week 5 counting as a bye week for both teams. This created a domino effect involving 6 other teams, along with New England and Denver. According to the Washington Post's Mark Maskey, league officials have discussed a different tactic, adding a week 18 to the season to handle any glut of makeup games. But until it has no other choice, the NFL will continue to reschedule games within the regular season's 17-week time frame, even though lengthening the season would not be a difficult task, at least on paper. Now we'll move on to a couple of other pre-recorded reports. This first is from NPR. New study predicts over 400,000 pandemic-related deaths in the U.S. this year.
The total number of deaths related to COVID-19 in this country could top 400,000 by the end of the year. That's according to a study out today in the medical journal JAMA. 400,000 is about the number of Americans who died in World War II. Joining me now to talk about how researchers came up with this number is NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Elsa.
So, you know, we've been reporting that the number of COVID deaths is a bit more than 200,000 now. I don't get it. Is that number actually going to double by the end of the year?
Well, no, because the study out today suggests that there's a undercounting of deaths that could be related to COVID-19. Let me explain. So Stephen Wolf is director of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University. And he and his colleagues looked at deaths from all causes this year and compared those to historical death rates. And this year was higher. So they figured that the explanation is COVID-19, because that's been the main difference in the health situation.
Right.
So why the discrepancy between the numbers they're getting and the numbers that are being reported? Well, they think there are two reasons. Wolf says one of the reasons is that some people just aren't having COVID-19 listed on their death certificates.
The second is people who do not have COVID-19, but die because of disruptions caused by the pandemic. So an example would be somebody has chest pain, they're scared to call 911 because they don't want to get the virus, and they die of a heart attack.
Okay, but that's not the same as dying from COVID-19.
No, but if you're trying to estimate the burden of the pandemic on American health and the nation's health, then it's certainly reasonable to count those kinds of deaths as blaming them on the pandemic.
Hmm. Okay, so I take these numbers are for the U.S. as a whole, but are there regional differences when it comes to the impact of COVID?
Yes, there were. In fact, states like New York and Massachusetts and Connecticut that responded aggressively when they saw their excess death rates ramp up at the start of the year also saw them come back to normal historical levels in about May, so about 7 or 8 weeks later. But states that never brought their outbreaks under control, they still continue to see a surge in these excess deaths, suggesting that public health measures was a big part in controlling things.
And do we have any idea whether these excess deaths, as you call them, from the pandemic are showing up in other countries?
Yes, this is a pattern that scientists are seeing in other countries, but there's an interesting twist. So there's a paper also being published in JAMA that compares how the excess death rates in the United States due to the pandemic compare to death rates in other countries that were hit hard, like Italy and Spain and France. And remember, these are rates, not actual numbers, because these are different sized countries. Ezekiel Emanuel of the University of Pennsylvania is a co-author of that study. He says at the start of the year, the excess deaths in those countries were fairly comparable with the United States, but then they started dropping down to levels closer to what they were before the pandemic. Emanuel says that wasn't the case for the U.S. So what were these countries doing that we weren't doing?
They didn't have a vaccine that we didn't have. They didn't have some special cocktail treatment that we didn't have. The difference is, how conscientiously did we implement public health measures, physical distancing, masks, keeping crowds small, not moving inside for social gatherings? And we perform poorly.
So is it possible to do better at this point and improve the situation here in the U.S.?
Yes, both Emanuel and Stephen Wolf from Virginia Commonwealth University say that implementing those measures that Emanuel was just talking about would make a big difference, and the death rate could come down significantly by the end of the year. And a vaccine will help, although when we get the vaccine and who will be able to get it, that's a topic for another day.
That's NPR's Joe Palca. Thank you, Joe.
You're welcome.
And finally, in our last pre-recorded report, we have something from NPR. The first coronavirus case in the U.S. was diagnosed about 9 months ago. NPR reconstructs the timeline of the pandemic in this country and talks about the months to follow. This runs 8 minutes.
About 9 months ago, January 19th, a 35-year-old man walks into an urgent care clinic north of Seattle. He complains of 4 days of coughing and fever and says he's just visited family in Wuhan, China. The doctor takes a few swabs. A few days later,
the alarming new development of that deadly mystery virus outbreak, the first case in the U.S. confirmed.
3 weeks later, the disease caused by that virus is given a name by the World Health Organization.
COVID-19, CO for corona, VI for virus, D for disease, and 19 because it started last year.
NPR's Will Stone has been tracing the course of the U.S. pandemic from its earliest days in Washington State. Hey there, Will.
Hi, Audie.
So we're going to talk through 5 key moments from this year that got us to where we are today. And we just told the story of the first known case in Washington. The next big story of the pandemic clearly was New York, right? The Northeast.
Yeah. When it hit New York City, the rest of the country realizes this isn't just a Washington problem.
Every single person that rolled in, tubed, unstable, respiratory failure.
People like David Lynn see the ERs in New York start filling up. He's a medical resident at the Mount Sinai Hospital.
COVID. Next one. Same. Next one. Same. And they were anyone, young, old.
And the city's standing up these makeshift hospitals. I mean, the Navy hospital ship arrives.
Yeah, the Comfort Now is just pulling into dock here in Midtown Manhattan.
And by early April,
and we talk about numbers,
Governor Cuomo is reporting these huge death tolls every day.
That's 731 people who we lost behind. And every one of those numbers is an individual, is a family.
And it becomes clear that healthcare workers are getting sick too. They're burning out. They're worried about their health.
We're afraid for each other. I'm afraid for myself. I'm a single mom.
Here was Dr. Suchita Shah at Harborview Medical Center in Seattle at the time.
I'm afraid to leave my kids without a parent. This week we started taking care of our own. You know, some of our residents are sick. This is a disease of healthcare workers too.
And there's also this realization that no one is going to have enough of anything to make it through. Masks, gowns, test kits.
Which sounds really bad and was really bad. But then things sort of slowed down as the country moved into May, right?
Yeah. So this is sort of the third big moment of the pandemic, this temporary reprieve towards the end of May, as the bigger cities are seeing deaths go down.
And it leads to a sense of complacency going into Memorial Day, right?
Yes.
You can't tell who's infected. And so that's why you have to continue to social distance.
And that's officials like Deborah Birx of the White House Coronavirus Task Force are worried.
When you go out for this weekend, Memorial Day, and you want to do some kind of social gathering, it's very important to maintain that 6 feet distance and very important to have your mask with you.
So it's not long before we start to see things basically tick back up again.
That's right. And that's when we get to the fourth big moment, this summer surge in California, Arizona, Texas, the South, which is also when we realize the type of people driving up the case numbers now is shifting. It's young people.
It sounded like officials in a way were starting to blame young people or millennials for what was going on. Here's how the mayor of St. Petersburg, Rick Kreisman, put it.
All of you millennials who thought you were immune to this virus, that the only people who were afflicted by coronavirus were baby boomers and those older than them, well, you were wrong.
Yeah, but that focus on young people also becomes somewhat of a distraction from the real problem, which is that states never closed down enough and they're reopening too fast. You saw this playing out, especially in Texas.
We don't have to choose between jobs and health. We can have both.
That was Governor Greg Abbott. That didn't turn out to be true. They needed further lockdowns.
And that's when you see states like Florida, right, breaking records with daily case numbers. At one point, 15,000 new cases a day, which was even worse than during New York's peak. And ERs are filling up.
So we are working many hours. I think at least 3 times more than we worked in the past.
Here's Dr. David De La Cerda at Jackson Memorial Hospital in South Florida.
I am really worried. We continue to see the influx we've seen in the last few days. We are going to reach our capacity by the end of the week.
By midsummer, cases are peaking. And then by mid-August, they descend significantly.
There's another lull, right? A brief one. It feels like a moment of calm. Is this when the U.S. starts to feel, the government starts to feel, that things are somewhat under control?
Yeah, cases are coming down. But even during this dip, we were still seeing more than 30,000 cases a day. And then by late August, we started to see a pickup of cases in the middle of the country. And in September, nationally, cases start rising again. And that sort of brings us to the fifth moment, where we are right now.
Where we are right now is 212,000 people in this country who have died from coronavirus.
That's right, Audie.
Looking back at the way that the virus moved across the U.S., early on, we heard about different waves. Is this actually a good way to think about it?
A wave does not quite capture it, because the pandemic has not crashed across the country all at once and then gone away. This is how Dr. Roger Shapiro at Harvard describes the U.S. coronavirus outbreak.
A better way of thinking about it is a wave that went into a pool, and in that pool, it's sloshing around. Wherever it hasn't been yet, it's going to go. The places where it has already been, it could go back.
So what we have now is this constant reservoir of disease splashing around, infecting people at different times in different places.
Now it's fall. We're going to be heading into winter. I'm not the only one, I'm sure, who's heard these predictions that the U.S. is going to see a big rise in cases as people spend more time indoors. Is the country prepared for this?
It's not. Overall, it looks pretty grim. The hope early on was that the country could take advantage of the summer, bring infections down a lot to get some breathing room before the fall and flu season. But as a country, we never got there. So now the prediction is that by the end of the year, the death toll will reach about 360,000. That estimate comes from modelers at the University of Washington, like Professor Ali Mokhtad. And Mokhtad says the U.S. is just stuck in a cycle.
We are in this like roller coaster in every location in the United States where it goes up and then we change our behavior. We bring it down, then we let down our guard, then it goes up again.
And Mokhtad says the data show this pattern of behavior all over the country. When infections get bad, more people put on masks, even where it's not required, and they stay home more. And then after cases drop, people aren't as careful. And this means places that have already gone through a really bad outbreak are vulnerable to another one. And immunity won't help because most of America still hasn't been infected.
So the biggest question going forward, are a lot of places that shut down in the spring, are they going to have to do that again in the winter?
As painful as they are, shutdowns can be effective. But Professor Mokhtad also told me that timing matters. Shutdowns have to be in place before hospitalizations spike. Otherwise, they're not nearly as effective as they could be, and you still get the economic pain.
Will Stone, thanks for walking us through it.
Thank you.
That is your coronavirus update for this Tuesday, October 13th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Coming up next, we'll bring you the national news from USA Today. And then, of course, at 3 o'clock, that's when we'll have our local two-hour newspaper broadcast. Here are some of the articles our volunteers will be reading. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, MISD Board approves $70,000 settlement with Riddick. Party chairs say no straight party voting means longer time at polls. Sheriff's Office to purchase armored vehicle for $300,000. From the Odessa American, man and woman charged in connection to death of 8-year-old girl. Judge rules in favor of the Odessa American. New pediatrician strives to improve children's lives. Juvenile detention plan aired. Commissioners view issuing $20 million in debt to finance new center. Those articles and more coming up at 3 o'clock. And then at 6 o'clock, of course, we'll have more news from the Wall Street Journal. As always, thank you very much for listening. We hope that this brings you more information about COVID-19 and its various...
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today.
followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 83 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library.